Welcome to the Lawyering Up podcast with Jarrett Ferrantino, Edward Ceramboli, and sometimes Greg Fellerman. Lawyering Up aims to be a podcast that two litigation lawyers, sometimes three, tackle civil law, criminal law, lawmakers, lawbreakers, and life itself with interviews that entertain, educate, and inform. We're lawyers. We love to talk. We love to talk about everything. We're going to consult with the best experts in the respective fields we discuss, and we're going to hammer it out litigation style for all of you.
You see Greg and I on the Law and You all the time, and we always say people come up to us in the supermarkets, they come up to us in, you know, in Lowe's, and they're always asking questions. And what we want to do with our good friend Jarrett Ferrantino is bring both civil litigation perspective, criminal litigation perspective, and also a common sense perspective to a lot of legal issues that just, you know, they cross geographic, they cross demographics, they cross politics, they cross, you know, every aspect of life. And we're going to bring a unique perspective. We're going to bring honest, you know, honest talk to these conversations as well. And we get to do a deeper dive on a lot of these really important issues than, you know, just being, you know, somebody just asking us in the supermarket or in Lowe's.
We may be lawyers. We're not going to talk like lawyers. We're not even going to act like lawyers. We want to provide a deep dive into some of the issues that impact your life from our perspective and every day and expert perspectives too.
Today's episode, we have a tremendous guest today, Carmen Ambrosina. Carmen is the former CEO of Wyoming Valley Drug and Alcohol. And why we're so excited about Carmen being here today is we're gonna talk about the opioid crisis. And this is literally a guy who has been on the front line in the trenches from day one and is still fighting this battle on the opioid crisis. It's really exciting for us to be our very first episode, having you as our first guest. And, you know, I'm Ed Ceramboli, and I'm going to let Jarrett introduce himself and my partner, Greg Fellerman, and then we'll get rolling.
I'm Jarrett Ferrantino. I'm a litigation, criminal, and civil lawyer here in Pennsylvania. Very excited to have the opportunity to have the speaker, author, administrator, and counselor in the addiction field. If there's a man that's worn many hats in addiction for the past 40 years, it's Carmen Ambrosina. But beyond that, I'm proud to call Carmen a friend. And anything I'm doing that I could crowbar Carmen into, I'm always happy to do so. So to have him here is a great pleasure, and I look forward to your insights and sharing with us. And one of the goals of our program really is to get people to offer insights that kind of dovetail into what we do in the litigation and lawyering world. And the addiction and lawyering world has collided on the issue of the opioid epidemic. Edward and Greg and I are involved in these opioid litigation, national litigation cases that have really been dominating the news cycle. We're fighting on behalf of municipalities and government entities that have really sustained great cost in the wake of the opioid epidemic. And our goal today really is to talk about what brought about the epidemic, what has happened since the late 90s and through the 2000s that brought us here to 2019, where we are and what we're dealing with. With that, Carmen, tell us a little bit about your professional background and your counseling and writing background.
Sure.
Carmen, one second.
Yes.
Before you do that, Jarrett said you were a friend. You're his friend. Now, do you agree with that or disagree with that?
No, I agree with that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, Jarrett, listen. Jarrett says a lot of things. So,
are you going to tell me he doesn't have lots of them?
Listen, is that what you're saying? If I had every friend be a guest on the show, we'd be able to do three episodes. Carmen would be one of them. So,
but they'd be long episodes.
Yes.
And before you get going, Greg, do you have anything you want to add before we get started?
Carmen, we've worked together for 20-plus years. He does a great job, and he's an absolute authority on this issue. He's no better guest.
Well, first of all, I'm really honored to be the first guest on the show. A real pleasure to be here today. My career started back in 1973 in the addiction field. And again, I retired after 41 years as a CEO for Wyoming Valley Alcohol and Drug Services. But the last 5 years has taken me doing a lot of consultation, and a lot has to do with opioids and the impact, again, that they continue to have on community. But for the 41 years, I worked with child welfare from 1970 through 73 as the institutional placement officer. And 90% of these cases were drug and alcohol related. And it wasn't primarily the child. It was the family where the child came from. And that, to me, became a common denominator, that in all these placements, chemical dependency was the number one factor. And I said to someone one day, I'm becoming more and more fascinated with the study, the research, investigation of drug and alcohol and the role it plays in all these societal issues. And I believe I was called into the field of addiction by my higher power. The job was a mission. It was cherry flavored for 41 years. I was there. There were ups and downs to it, but at the end of the day, I did not have a bad day. And I got a chance to see over 10,000 patients face-to-face who came into my office. I got a chance. The government sent me on 3 international trips. I went to Cuba and had an opportunity for 1 week to work with the Cubans on addiction issues. I went to South Africa for 2 weeks. Dominican Republic for 1 week. And as a delegate, one of just a few handpicked to go over and to try to talk about some of the common issues of chemical dependency and what my experiences were like. And lastly, I served on state boards. I was the president of the certification board, the board that issues certification to counselors statewide, several thousand, and was there for 14 years in that capacity. And then I served on 2 national boards representing Pennsylvania. So a lot of experience was not only Luzerne County based, but it gave me an opportunity to kind of expand in the state, national. And when you look at addiction, addiction is very similar. Addiction first affects the individual and then the family, the community, the state, the nation, and the world. It permeates all those aspects. And so that when you look at this chemical dependency problem, it's really pandemic. It's not an epidemic. It's worldwide. And it touches every fiber, every aspect of our community.
Carmen, let me take you back to 1970 for a minute.
Yes.
Because very candidly, Jerry and I weren't alive. Greg was in high school in 1970. In 1970, when you really started on this journey.
Yes.
Did you know anybody that died from opioids in 1970?
No.
When was the first time that you can remember somebody dying from opioid abuse?
I began to see the escalation of the opioid issue in probably the early 80s. Again, I started in chemical dependency in 1973. So the first 7 years, we saw some of it, but not to the point where it became, it took up our every waking hour after that. This thing just escalated like a freight train out of control. And it's a major, major issue. There are 930 Luzerne Countyans that have died from drug overdoses in the last 10 years. That's 93 per year. There are 4,600 Pennsylvanians who die from drug overdoses every single year. And there are 64,000 across the United States who die from drug overdoses. And about 42,000 of the 64,000 are opioid related. In Pennsylvania,
that's
of the
staggered.
4,600,
staggered.
85% in Pennsylvania opioid related. This is a problem that we have not been able to get our arms around.
I think that number too, Carmen, is just a glimpse. That's the extremes. Okay, when you get to the point where you die, we got to talk about the folks that are living with this addiction too, not to the point where they're dead or they're being brought back. You know, we talk about 90% of your child placements were drug fueled. 90% plus of crime is drug fueled. So we talk about the pandemic nature of this too. And we have an entire society, almost a lost generation of people managing or coping or living with this addiction. Their children are being raised in many cases by their grandparents. They're coming to our communities and government to be on programs and for assistance. This is the collateral damage of the pandemic. And I think it is a pandemic. I agree with you. I think, and I know on a personal level, you have touched so many lives of individuals, but do you think this has been a conflagration of addiction? Did you ever see this coming?
No. Anyone who says that they saw it coming is not really being truthful. This thing has really moved over the mountain real quick, like, and once it got the roots, and it just has been escalating. And still, despite the best efforts and countermeasures, and people saying we've seen a decline, it's still rearing its ugly head the same way it was for the past 25 to 30 years. Opioid addiction and use. My entire caseload, the last 10 years of my career, were white-collar professionals. They were not individuals from anywhere else other than white-collar professionals. And the number one factor was the opioid usage. The thing with opioids is they are so powerful, and the cutting agents that they are being cut with. Chemicals are cut with either active cuts or the inactive cut. The active cut will provide back into that drug the bite. The inactive cut puts the bulk back in. So that if you were to take someone who would water down the ketchup bottle at home, most people would know that. But if you had someone who was pretty creative, who put something back in that ketchup to make it the same taste as the regular ketchup and to make it as consistent as regular ketchup, it'd be pretty hard to know that someone has duped that. And so these cuts, fentanyl, 100 times more powerful than heroin. Carfentanil. Carfentanil is an opioid that's used for elephant and for lions and bears when you're doing surgery on them. This is, if you can believe it or not, 5,000 times more potent than heroin. And so these are additives.
Carmen, carfentanil doesn't even have to be ingested. It could be just through touch contact.
That is correct. That's why EMTs and professionals, your ambulance personnel, are all cautioned. They're all drilled about you can touch this substance and you can get off on it. You can get a reaction, and this can be fatal. So,
and we're seeing now, too, some of the charges that we're seeing coming out of both here in northeastern Pennsylvania and beyond. I can't remember the last time I didn't see a heroin bust where the heroin didn't contain fentanyl.
Yeah.
We're seeing it every day, including today. Mm-hmm. So that particular cutting agent, so the drugs, not only are they more prevalent, they're more potent, they're more deadly, and they're cheaper, aren't they?
Yes, you can get heroin on the street anywhere from $5 to $20. A gram of heroin may run $150, and that gives you 20 bags. It's very cheap. It's cheaper than a pack of cigarettes.
And I always tell people, we talk about a gram of heroin. 1 gram, for folks, you can remember, is a sugar packet. Mm-hmm. Sugar packet is 1 gram. So when we hear people talk about grams, that's the level, or that's the amount we're talking about. Let's talk a little bit about how we got here, where we're talking about heroin and how it's being cut. Let's go back to, you said something about white collar addiction and some of what you're seeing in the last 10 years of your career. What brought us there and what we're seeing now, what we're learning now, was the drug manufacturers, companies like Purdue, Johnson & Johnson, began to manufacture and distribute pain management and OxyContin,
Percocets.
And these narcotics were distributed as pain management drugs as opposed to their original intended use, which was for major pain, of cancer treatments and things like that. Pain, as I've heard it said, became essentially the new vital sign. Everybody that goes into the doctor's offices sees these happy faces now. That's the new thing. And the goal, when pain was the vital sign, was to get everybody to their happy place.
Yes.
And to get everybody there, they were using opioids and downplayed the addictive nature of the opioid. And this was way back in the 90s. What happens to individuals that were treated with an opioid for its unintended original purpose, which was for major pain? They were managed on an opioid, and then that opioid is cut off from their doctor. What have you seen?
You brought up a couple points which I'd like to react to. Number one, the AMA added pain as the fifth vital sign. Pulse, blood pressure, temperature, and respiration were the four that were always used. They added pain as the fifth vital sign. and put emphasis on it. If you remember, you went into a hospital and it was a little smiling face. The one who frowned was one, the smiling face was 10. And they were asking patients, many of whom were using opioids, how's your pain threshold, your pain level? And most people were putting down that it was a 1, and they needed to have pain medications. The main issue that drove this argument was there was a research project that was done by Porter and Dr. Jick, J-I-C-K. And if people want to look up the research of Porter and Jick, they interviewed 12,000 patients who were using opioids. And they concluded in this faulty survey that only 4 patients were hooked on opioids of the 12,000 that had been treated with opioid medication.
And I have familiarity with that study. That is a subjective study. It's basically what people were telling them. And that's in the field was one of the great difficulties. If you're addicted to a painkiller, you're going to come in, you're going to tell your doctor you're in a greater degree of pain because you want more of the opioid, correct?
Yes.
And there's no measurement. You can't MRI the pain. It's a subjective complaint, correct?
Yes.
And that's why we've seen these doc-in-a-box operations and that kind of thing across the country.
Yes.
The pill mills and everything.
Yes, right.
I mean, and it's, you know, Jared hit the nail right in the head. I mean, you're going to ask an addict whether they're an addict. How many addicts are going to say, I'm an addict? I mean, the study was, they did this study. Tell her who funded that study.
That I'm not sure of, but where it ended up is in the New England Journal of Medicine, and that became the standard bearer. That standard bearer went out to pharmaceutical companies and the physicians' offices. That is viewed as being the kicking off point to this major escalation of the opioids. That this was legitimate now in people's eyes, in the medical community, that, hey, out of 12,000 opioid patients, only 4 had addiction? Wow. Along that time, pharmaceutical companies took advantage of that and started to escalate the production. Along that, the clandestine or street chemists began to put out more heroin and more fentanyl. Along that time as well came these pill mills, unscrupulous healthcare providers who said, wow, we now can make a great deal off of these products. Internet and social media sites went crazy with the marketing and the selling of these opioids. Doctor shopping and pharmacy hopping became popular. Now, with the new pharmaceutical monitoring program in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, we cut a lot of that out. But at the time, it was not there.
A lot of people were unhappy when that went off.
Absolutely.
And what did they do?
How many calls did you get in your office from people who got cut off from their medications because they were overreaching and getting too much, and then they went into total panic?
America always misses the middle. It goes from one extreme to the other. Mm-hmm. And when they started to try to grapple with this opioid problem, they came out with countermeasures that was either some or none. And the problem is that there are legitimate individuals with pain issues in the United States.
Absolutely.
And millions upon millions of people who weren't able to get access to pain medication. So we're not saying that pain medication is bad. We're saying the way the pain medication was being prescribed, 250 million prescriptions every year in the United States are written by physicians. 250 million. And a large percentage, the primary care physician is top of the list, followed by the specialty doctor in second place in terms of opioid prescriptions.
Carmen, stay on that for topic for a minute, because, you know, when you say they're being prescribed these, you know, these prescriptions have escalated over the years so much, and kind of going back for a minute, you know, the reason I asked you to go back to 1970 was because you didn't know anybody had died from opioids. Jared and I, we were talking today at lunch. I mean, we were in high school. We didn't know anybody that died from opioids. Greg didn't know anybody that died from opioids. But yet the next generations I have a 23-year-old son. I could ask him today, do you know anybody that died from opioid? He could probably name me a dozen people that he knows. So, you know, there was a real shift, as Jared was mentioning, right around 1990 when this study, you know, study came out and they started.
When did the study come out?
It was about right around
1980 was the study, I believe.
And then they really started to pump this stuff. But now you have these tremendous, they're Schedule I narcotics. I mean, these are heavy-duty drugs that are being prescribed for things that used to get Motrin or Tylenol for.
Yes.
Well, in our practice, too, I remember in the early 2000s, you know, we do a lot of with injured people. And all of a sudden, in the notes and from our clients, we would hear that they were prescribing them OxyContin, which when I was in the DA's office, we knew that was a bad drug. And these people, they were writing them like they were M&Ms. And then, you know, very few people could manage that. You remember, you could manage being on that, and they had a very hard time coming off it. And that's when I noticed that, and this is the early 2000s, and then it just went, it tipped over the edge.
And that's when it was. Let's talk about the nature of the addiction, Carmen. It's a new kind of addiction, isn't it?
If you can be a little bit more specific.
Is it an emotional addiction? Is it, what about an opioid causes someone to become addicted?
The thing with opioid addiction is it's almost instantaneous. The chemicals are that powerful that there's very little progressive window, if you will. When you look at alcoholism, and if there's such a thing as an average alcoholic, it takes years, many times, to move from A through Z and go over the line. Not with opioids. Opioids, you're there quickly. There are some opioids out there in the cutting agents that you can get hooked on those, addicted to those almost immediately.
And what's physically happening that becomes addictive, though, Carmen? And that, when I say new type of addiction, it's the instantaneous addiction. What physically happens to a person? You know, I've heard, I prosecuted an individual, and we talked about, this guy would steal your mother-in-law if he could.
Yes.
Okay, his crimes were drug-fueled.
Yes.
And he said that he felt like when he started using cancer or heroin, he gave himself cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a physical, this isn't just a desire
to get
high.
It's a brain disease. It alters the chemical structure of the brain. And with opioids, it alters it very quickly, very rapidly. And so you're talking about decision-making, reasoning, sound judgment, intelligence, delayed gratification. Now, all those things are compromised. You're talking about impulsivity. You're talking about, I remember opioid addicts in some of my groups used to tell me, Carmen, were you ever hungry, really hungry? Times it by 1,000.
And take that. So take those dulled inhibitions, changes in their mindset. Is that why we're seeing a break from, we have an individual who can go to a doctor with a prescription to somebody in a back alley buying black tar heroin?
Yes. Yeah, and you can buy them on the internet because the internet is worldwide. The United States can do everything in its power to try to control it. You have to control the access to it across the world. Until recently, there were no standards for prescribing opioids. I sat on a committee in the state of Pennsylvania put together by the Pennsylvania Medical Society, one of about 18 individuals, and we came up with the guidelines for ER doctors, for dentists, and for primary care doctors in terms of how to prescribe opioids. And I was shocked to learn that there were no opioid prescribing guidelines available. Now there are. But I mean, we're talking 10, 12 years ago, these were non-existent. And there was very little education by manufacturers of these products.
A lot of marketing.
Yes, a lot of marketing, but very little education and very little oversight. The oversight was nil. So the government and different entities that are required or should be there, making sure that all the bases are being touched, were not there. This thing caught us by surprise. So this horse is out of the barn. Horses are out of the barn, and we're trying our best. There have been some wonderful countermeasures, but there's still a long way to go.
Well, let's talk about the horse is truly out of the barn. And this is where the Carmen Ambrosinos of the world come in, isn't it? Where we get folks to try to rehabilitate individuals, rehabilitate broken lives, rehabilitate physical rehabilitation, spiritual, emotional rehabilitation. Tell us, first of all, what is that process like for an individual coming off an opioid addiction to be truly rehabilitated?
That's a great question. What we need to understand is when physicians are treating cancers, diabetes, heart problems, they are treating the disease. When we as a chemical dependency professionals, we first have to get through the lying, the deceit, the manipulation, the intellectualization, the rationalization. These are part built into addiction is denial. The river in Egypt, denial. We see it 100% of the times with addicts. And so when a family says to the addict, hey, we're going to give you this opportunity to go in for treatment, and if you fail, we're going to walk, then you might as well say to the diabetic, if you eat the wrong foods on the menu ever in your recovery, we're going to walk. Or to the heart patient, or to, you can't say that, because you've got to understand this disease, especially opioids. The addict has no clue what they need and doesn't have any idea that they're in peril, they're in trouble. So once we help the addict and work through all those dimensions, we then find the addict at time. There's only two reasons why people use drugs: increase the pleasure or decrease the pain. And 90% of people in life want to decrease their pain. We call them isms, ISM for the listener. Very important to understand that.
Physical pain and emotional pain too.
Yes, we're talking about. Yes. That's the other side.
It's a cycle. I mean, you don't have one without the other. I mean, you'll never meet, I would say, but you're never going to meet somebody who just says, you know what, today I woke up this morning. It's a beautiful day here in northeastern Pennsylvania. I think it's a great idea to go buy some black tar heroin and inject it into my arm that has never done heroin or any drug before. So there's a progression. You know, they have something happened to them in their life to first go to a doctor to be prescribed an opioid. And then from that, you know, pain has a depressive effect. So now the opioid only enhances that. And now you start this vicious cycle of you have physical pain, you have emotional, you know, pain. And so how do you, I mean, really, like, how do you break that cycle if you can?
Your comments are right on target. I often said to people when I spoke that you can go to any sixth grader in the world, ask them what they want to be when they grow up, and they'll tell you a center field for the Yankees, a rock star, an entertainer, whatever they will tell you. Not one will ever tell you.
Has anybody ever said to you they want to be Jared Farentino?
One, his son.
Yeah, Dominic.
There's not one that will tell you, I want to be an addict. I want to wake up in my own vomit. I want to wake up with my picture on page one in cuffs. I want to wake up to the point where I want to take my life. If no one ever looks to become an addict, why are there millions of people that are addicts in the world? And to your point, if you were to say to the average individual, if you stop using drugs and alcohol, do your problems stop? The uninformed say, yes, if you take away the drugs and alcohol, the problem. Drugs and alcohol are the masquerades. That's the masquerade as to why we're using. And so that you can detoxify a person 100 times and get them free and clear of drugs. And within 3 to 4 months, they're back using. And people are scratching their heads saying, how come they are? As a little boy, my father used to tell me to go pull dandelions in the backyard. It was every Saturday. Angrily, I would do that. And so I'd pull the flowering tops of the dandelions out of the grass. And my father would come off the porch with a little paring knife, and he'd say, son, you have to get the root of the dandelion. You got to cut down deep enough to find the root of that dandelion. If not, those flowering tops are going to be back next Saturday and you're going to repeat this exercise. What he was helping me clearly understand is the root causes of addiction are the isms. If you take alcoholism and you remove alcohol from the disease of alcoholism, what's left is ISM, the ism. That's the root. That's what we treat. And it comes in various flavors, those roots. It comes in low self-esteem. It comes in feelings of being worthless. It comes in being overwhelmed. It comes in not liking who we are. It comes in not having coping mechanisms.
Victims of abuse and that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And so that somewhere along the line, this ism, this root, hurts so bad, so deep. I don't care who the individual is, that we reach out for something, and all of a sudden, very magically, whether it's marijuana or cocaine or the opioids, it makes me feel better. I can cope and get through today. And with the opioids, especially those that are prescribed, there's a legitimacy to them because they come from physicians, and my third-party insurance company pays for it.
It gave it a real cleansing, didn't it? It made drug use and abuse legit in the eyes of the user. So we're talking about multifaceted treatment. You got to treat the disease and all its symptoms, right? You got to treat the emotional, the spiritual, the physical. And if you don't, you're going to be back next Saturday taking those dandelions out, right?
If I'm still diseased inside, if you've missed those areas, those pieces of my dandelion that still have roots to them, if you haven't helped me pull those and get them out of me somewhere in treatment, something's going to trigger a relapse down the line.
Thanks for listening to the Lawyer Up Podcast, a production of Fellerman and Zaramboli. This is part one of our special two-part inaugural episode. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts to hear the conclusion. This episode was edited and polished by NX2 Marketing. To learn more about the topics discussed on this show, or if you have a question for our legal team, visit bellermanlaw.com.